all of you. Thank you all for being here. And this is the first session that Aspen Institute India is organizing in Jamia Millia Islamia. And we are very privileged that, this is starting from the Department of Political Science. This is interesting because I'm an alumnus of this department, passing out in 2010. And on a personal note, it is very special for me. I want to thank Professor Alam for all his support in helping us do this, and Professor Mann for sparing time for the introduction. Before I hand over the stage to Professor Alam, I would like to brief you on Aspen Institute India's activities, because it might help you in the long run. Aspen Institute India was established under an MOU between the CII, the Confederation of Indian Industries, and Aspen Institute US, which is one of the world's leading think tanks. However, over the years, we have evolved into an independent entity, and we are working on foreign policy, domestic policy, and values-based leadership. Under the foreign policy aspect, we organize track two dialogues with different countries. Some of our ongoing track two dialogues are with US, Europe, ASEAN, China, Singapore, Turkey, Israel. And we also organize closed-door meetings, public sessions on a range of bilateral and multilateral issues, economics, politics, everything. On domestic policy front, we again organize public sessions. We produce policy briefs, policy papers on a range of issues of national concerns, which includes human rights, political aspects, and even administration, bureaucracy. On the values-based leadership front, we have a leadership initiative. It's called the Shriram Schools Aspen Leadership Initiative, in which we reach out to school students, even college, university students, and hear from them. We have an India Talk series in which we reach out to different university students and get their views on burning issues of the time. So these are some of the three aspects, and then we hope for your continued support towards the activities. And with that, I would like to hand over the stage to Professor Arun.
Thank you, Samar, for a very nice succinct introduction. A very warm good morning to all of you, my colleagues in the Department of Political Science, our students in Political Science, Public Administration, Human Rights. I think this is a great moment for us that we have got a distinguished historian, a distinguished journalist, and a distinguished scholar among us, James Mann. James Mann has got wide experiences. He has served in many different places, and he just told me that he has spent a long time in Beijing when I was also spending my time in US. He was a senior writer in residence at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He served as staff writer for LA Times, Los Angeles Times, including positions as Beijing Bureau Chief, National Security Correspondent, and Foreign Affairs Columnist. He was a staff writer for New Haven Journal Courier, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Baltimore Sun. These are all the high-profile newspapers published in the United States. He received the National Press Corps Edwin Hood Award for Diplomatic Correspondence in 1993 and also 1999. The Edward Wendell Prize for Diplomatic Reporting in 1999, the New York Public Library Helen Bernstein Award for Best Book of the Year by Journalist in 2000, and the Asia Pacific Award for Best Book About Asia in 2000. He was a finalist for the Lionel Gibber Prize for Books on International Relations in 2000 and the Arthur Rush Book Prize in 2005. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, formerly a guest scholar at the Woodrow Wilson School, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Fellow of the American Academy in Berlin. He's a guest commentator for television and radio network. He's also teaching courses in Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. He also has a graduate degree from Harvard University. Among his publications are The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, A History of the End of Cold War, published in 2009, The China Fantasy, How Our Leaders Explain Away Chinese Repression, 2007, Rise of the Balkans, The History of Bush War Cabinet, 2004, About Face, The History of America's Curious Relationship with China from Nixon to Clinton, 1999, Beijing Jeep, 1989, and a lot of articles in the Atlantic Monthly, The New Republic, and the Washington Post. Today's topic, as you know, and as we have advertised, the rise of China in the global order. perspective from US and India. China, as you know, I think those of us we study about, and students, and also having some expertise on aspect of East Asia and also Asia Pacific, China is everywhere. In fact, I picked up today's newspaper, the Times of India, and you can see China. India and China, the sealed border pact, they talk, Pak, past terror. There are a lot of issues which is South Asian, Pan Asian, Asia, Southeast Asia. So wherever you go, I mean, 3 weeks ago I was in Taipei, Taiwan, we discussed everything other than India and Taiwan, only talk about China, China and China. And also I think in today's paper also, if you go to the page 17, Manmohan stars in Chinatown. This was in today's newspaper. And it's like one step forward and one step back. We have signed some agreement, the Prime Minister was there in Beijing a couple of days ago. So there are some movements, okay? I think among mature relationship, it's not necessary that we agree on everything. There will be some convergences, there will be some divergences. I think the key important thing lies in having the engagement. And talking about engagement, we also, during the Cold War years, we came across this often popular term called containment. And Jalme Khalilzad, who was the American ambassador to Afghanistan, he used this word called congagement, meaning a curious mix of both containment and also engagement. So the thing is, I mean, China, we deal with China, whether it is security issues, whether it is trade issues, commerce issues, the issue of our energy issues in Central Asia, the issue of our stapled visa, the issue of our incursion into Tawang province in Arunachal Pradesh, the issue of our Brahmaputra Dam, the agreement was signed, the issue of our South China Sea, the issue in WTO, the Doha round of negotiations. So China is everywhere. The issue of India's entry into the UN Security Council as a permanent member. So I think there are a lot of issues. The same thing with US. The US does engage with China, doesn't mean that they agree on every single thing. And maybe there is a kind of tussle between the sole hegemon and the declining hegemon, maybe whatever you can call it, and also the rising hegemon, or have the hegemonic ambitions or the assertive roles of China. Having all these words, so let me again invite and give a big round of applause to James Mann for coming.
Thank you, Professor, and thank you all for coming. I want to start today by looking at what China has become over the last 30 years, and then talk about where it is headed and possible approaches to it. So many of you know, you can read in the papers, you have a sense of China as an economic power. But to bring it home on the personal level, I can say that I arrived in China in 1984, before all of you were born, at the time when China was just starting its economic reform program. That is, if you study China, you will learn, and it's correct, that the economic reforms date back to 1979 when Deng Xiaoping became the Communist Party leader. That is correct, but the first 5 years, very important, were in the countryside, where the thrust of the reforms was to end communes and just let peasants grow their own plots. That worked, but it took until 1984, around the time I arrived, for them to begin to take on the larger questions outside the countryside. And so that fall, the party announced that it would begin to let prices float for the first time. They would no longer be controlled or fixed. And they would begin to let people start their own businesses. There could be private businessmen. And so I can remember the weekend after they announced this, just to see, I went out to the main department store in Beijing, Wang Fu Jing it was called, to look at how the price reform, whether it was being implemented. And I went to the home product selling, the part of the department store selling refrigerators, and they had maybe 20 refrigerators lined up there, and 19 of them looked the same and new, and one of them had clearly been returned. It had dents, and it had scratches, and it was kind of a mess. And I watched because one person came up and said, how much will you take for this refrigerator, which was a radical thing to say. All the refrigerators, the standard price was about 900 yuan, maybe a couple hundred dollars. And the people got together and they thought about it and they said, for this refrigerator, the one that was a mess, 897. And that was a big dramatic step for China. And in the 1980s, when I was there, the private businessman meant somebody who was really kind of on the outs with elite China and Chinese society. It was someone who didn't have a job good enough to keep and wanted to take a risk. And I can remember following a guy who was running his own one-man photo shop in the streets of Dalian. And that he by himself was a famous figure because he dared to enter private business. Well, it took less than a decade for China to figure out that actually you could have a different kind of private business. You could you could privatize major industries, actually the way the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, was doing in Russia. You could have them go private, and then you could set up the sons, uncles, nephews, brothers of senior military and party officials as private businessmen to own some of the shares. And so private business in China became something very different, very closely connected to the government and to government-run banks. But it worked. And so you have a situation today where you have even by the standards of the United States and certainly by the standards of India, disparities of wealth now that are truly amazing. So just to take a couple of stories from the last couple months in the newspapers, Britain's leading butler service, I didn't know such things existed, but to train butlers for private wealthy households, just decided to open up operations in China because there was a greater prospect for growth for butlers in China than there is certainly in Britain. And separately, there was a study of the personal wealth of members of the US Congress and China's National People's Congress, and it found that the Chinese members of their Congress were richer by 100-fold than the members of the U.S. Congress. I think the richest member of the U.S. Congress, who's a jerk named Daryl Issa, has $300,000, but the richest member of the National People's Congress has tens of billions of dollars. So that's the China that we're seeing today. It is remarkably economically powerful with great disparities of wealth. That's one part. That's the economic part. On the political side, there's been really amazingly little progress over the last 30 years in the sense of political change. So when I was in China in the 80s, there was talk of a degree of political reform that would fall short of democracy, would fall short of ending the one-party system in China, but moderate reforms that would open up the press to greater to freedom, actually, and give the legislature supervisory power over the government. And that the movement towards those reforms built up in the 1980s and then stopped and with the events that led to the Tiananmen massacre of 1989. And today, after 30 years, basically, China is right back where it was in the 80s. That is, there is talk of change in China, but that talk stands exactly in the same place as it did in the 1980s. Maybe a little bit back, more backwards, because in the 1980s, the leadership in China was more receptive to the idea of change politically, and now it's more determined to repress political dissent. So economic power, strikingly little political change, and then growing military power in a way that frankly shouldn't surprise anyone. I mean, China is now both has the money to spend on the military, and really it's not unusual for a country developing extraordinary economic power to begin to develop the military power that goes along with it. So what happens with this odd mix? China is a rising power with all kinds of problems and nervousness about internal stability. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party worries regularly about making sure that it will maintain its own power and preventing political upheaval. And so I really lay out three different scenarios of what could happen in China, and different people operate with different views of these scenarios. The first view is what I would call, I wrote a book called The China Fantasy. Most of the books I write, I try to leave my own views out or in the background, because I've been for many years a reporter and a journalist, and I tend to believe that if you both lay out and also uncover and expose the facts, that by itself is extremely important. And I did a couple of books on China and elsewhere that were very clinical and analytic. And finally, in 2006, I did do one polemic that was about American policy towards China, and it was called The China Fantasy. And it lays out these three possible futures for China. The first is what I call the soothing scenario. And the soothing scenario was the basis of American policy towards China really from the 80s, or if you want to count it this way, from the 70s on. And it goes like this, that with growing trade and investment, and as China becomes more prosperous, its political system will inevitably morph towards a political opening. So this was the kind of assumption in the United States about China, it really in both parties. This has not been the subject of partisan divisions. So if you look at the statements of Bill Clinton said, you know, I think democracy is coming to China just as inevitably as the Berlin Wall fell. And that is, you know, an explicit assumption. George W. Bush said roughly the same thing. And the underlying American policy towards China has been to hope that with trade and investment, China would simply enter the international order as we know it, that it would accept the order kind of established with the United States as the leader after World War II. I call it the integrationist assumption. And one of the beliefs underlying this assumption is that China would follow the path of Asian countries like Taiwan, South Korea, which had authoritarian governments, and then in the 1980s moved towards democracy. And I don't believe that. I mean, I don't believe that that's the path China will follow. South Korea and Taiwan, first of all, are much smaller countries, even South Korea. But secondly, if you look at the history, they had a different relationship with the United States. So you had the United States pushing, goading them to open up. When there were protests in the streets, or when their opposition was building up and the authoritarian leadership didn't want to change, both these countries had not just relationships but military relationships with the United States. You can even date, if it's South Korea, I can give you a date in 1980, 1948, I believe, when the U.S. went to Chun Doo-hwan, the South Korean leader, and said, we really think you should give way to the protests in the streets and hold an election. Well, China doesn't have that relationship. There's no one with the United States. There's no one that's going to encourage, push China to democratize in any serious way. So I don't believe that assumption. So one way or another, I have trouble seeing how the soothing scenario is going to work. I can give you statements of leading American-China hands going back to the 90s saying, well, it'll take about 10 years, but eventually the Chinese Communist Party is going to hold elections. And maybe it'll decide to do it under a very controlled way. Maybe it will be like the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan and just win every election or almost every election. Maybe it'll be like the Congress Party in India. It will be a dominant party. But that's what's going to happen. And people believe that. And it hasn't happened, and it hasn't happened because I think the assumptions are wrong. So the second of the scenarios is what I would call the collapse scenario. And there are people from time to time who say, look, this can't last. There's too much unrest in China, and eventually the leadership is just going to topple and it's going to fall apart. There are regional differences. Maybe the East Coast will break off from the rest of the country. Maybe Tibet and Xinjiang in the West will break off from the country. And as evidence for this, they point out some statistics which are accurate, that there are now maybe 80,000 incidents a year in China. They're reported, I think the Chinese term is incidents or mass incidents, but they're either strikes or protests, people in the streets. And so from these, which are China's own figures, they say this can't hold together. Well, I actually don't think. China has a long history of holding together, certainly for the core of China, Tibet and Xinjiang are other stories. And I don't see that China is going to split up either. So what you're left with, what I call the third scenario, is that we are going to be dealing for a relatively long time with China as it is today, that despite that there's not going to be substantial political change, but the economy is going to remain powerful. And there may be blips. There's fantastic debates in the paper now or among academics about whether China is about to go into a downturn, so that the growth rate will go from 10 or 7 to 10, maybe down to 5. That would be important. It would affect not just China but the rest of the world. But that's a blip. One way or another, China is going to remain an already powerful and growing country. And so what I call the third scenario, which is that China will be for decades an authoritarian regime, which is able, because it does have the power to repress dissent, it will be able to manage to stick it out in the current form. I will leave with one other thing. At the time I wrote this book, I portrayed the Chinese middle class as, to put it bluntly, bought off. This was only about 7 or 8 years ago. But at the time it seemed to me, and it's still largely true, that the middle class is not the source of protests in China, as for example, in South Korea or Taiwan. People in the middle class have gotten a tremendous amount of prosperity, apartments, cars, unhappy with the system, essentially happy with the system, nervous about what would happen if, say, 600 million peasants got the right to vote equally with them. And the right to travel and so on. In the last 3 years, we've seen something important that causes me to wonder whether that my own assumption was right. And we've seen a trilogy, I think, of things that have caused extensive middle class unhappiness, and they're things that you see in the papers from time to time. The first, for middle class professionals in places like Beijing, Shanghai, and many other cities, the air pollution is so bad that people are afraid to raise their kids in it. And so where I used to see in the, 15 years ago, I would see Chinese young professionals deciding to move back to China from the United States because they had they were suddenly getting jobs that were as good as or better than they could get in the United States in China and could live very comfortably there and of course had family there. I'm now starting to see the reverse. Chinese professionals who say, I don't want to raise my kids in Beijing or Shanghai. And that's just the tip of the iceberg for tremendous unhappiness about the environment in a tangible way. Secondly, there is product safety. So there have been scandals, again, affecting everyone, where people find that the milk that they buy has been tainted, that really there's no one monitoring and enforcing the rules to make sure that what gets sold in the stores was not stripped down and poisoned. And that's become a source of discontent to the point where families are sending a representative or some member out regularly to Hong Kong or to Europe just to buy simple daily products like milk products, for example. And the third is internet censorship. So you get tremendous middle class unhappiness in a very intangible way with the fact that the internet is censored. It's if you're an educated person, it's kind of an insult to keep finding when you're looking for something online that you're not smart enough to read this. And China has started to respond to that in a very Chinese way by setting up there's now a special zone in Shanghai, one part of one city where the internet is free. But they have trouble figuring out how to deal with that and to deal with the fact that if you really open it up, people are going to see a level of criticism of the Chinese system that they're not prepared to handle. So I'm going to conclude there. That's the China that we have. That's the China that we see. You can pick among these three scenarios, but I think that's the China we will be dealing with for the next 20 years. And let me stop there. I have some thoughts on India, but I'll save them for questions. Shall I sit, or you want me to stand for the? Yeah.
Thank you, Professor Mann, for a very illuminating lecture.
I think we all learned a great deal about it.
I think now it's the most interesting part, I guess. This is the interactive sessions, so please feel free to ask any questions, make any comments, any opinions, okay? No holds back. So I think we'll take just a couple of questions, maybe in one cluster, if possible.
Sir, I have a question.
Yes.
I'm Dr. Raju. I teach comparative politics in this department. Professor Mann, you said Chinese middle class is happy because of material prosperity.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you said Chinese professionals don't want to raise their children in Beijing.
Right.
I see some kind of contradiction.
Well, that's what I'm saying is, at the time I wrote this book, I felt, I think rightly, that that the Chinese middle class was very happy. And in the last 5 years since I've written the book, I've found that there is growing disenchantment. So if there is a contradiction, it's in favor of the disenchantment now. Five or 6 years ago, I think that wasn't there. Really, it's not just that the air, for example, is bad. It's much worse. And the product safety has been a constant, but maybe a little worse, or maybe people are just more unhappy with it. But one way or another, I think the disenchantment is growing in response to conditions.
But the liberal idea that if you have a growing and huge middle class, that is conducive for growth of liberal democracy.
Yes.
That should lead to some kind of political, you know, liberalization. But on the other hand, we see growing economic prosperity, as you said.
Right.
But on the other hand, we don't see any change of, you know, political, you know, liberalization happening.
Right.
Is it because of the problem with liberal theory, or can we think that Chinese communists are learning the lessons from mistakes done by Soviet communists?
Well, first, is it a problem with the theory? Yes, I do think. You know, I know that there is. You all, or many of you, are international relations students. I know there's you know, all kinds of theory that claims to say that growing prosperity will lead to a political opening. And as a reporter and journalist, I question that. I'm not a theorist, but it seems to me that the theory doesn't match what I see in China, where the power of the state to limit middle class efforts to organize is very good. I mean, is very strong. And then wait, there was a second part of your question I was going to. Well, the theory.
Yes, economic prosperity leading to political.
Right. Okay.
And the Soviets.
On the Soviets. Yeah, you know, the Chinese have learned from this a lot from the Soviets, but it's not in this area, I don't think. The Chinese Communist Party, lesson number one from the Soviet Union is that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't want that to happen, and that they go to extreme lengths to prevent two things. The first is no Chinese Gorbachev. There's a reason that Chinese leaders since then have seemed so bland. Because, yes, there is a president, Communist Party secretary, but he can't do much, if anything, without a consensus. And if leaders emerge who seem too dynamic, things happen to them. So we've just seen in the last year party leader Bo Xilai kicked out from the party. That's a classic example. But they don't want any leader who becomes so strong and is so creative that it might take China down the path of the Soviet Union. And the second thing is they want to prevent splits within the party. That applies less to the Soviet Union than to China's own history, because you had serious divisions in the Chinese Communist Party that led to the Cultural Revolution in the 60s, that led to the Tiananmen Square crackdown and so on. So that's the lessons it takes.
I have a question about the three scenarios that you're talking about, and for me, I read a lot about those. Mm-hmm. What exactly is the problem with China as a non-democracy? I mean, we can say democracies are more likely to, or like going back to the democratic peace and whatever, but at the same time, we have the president of India and the United States that were both democracies and that actually weren't very close. And India was more anti-establishment for a long time than China. And you also have Chinese public nationalism that is a lot stronger than elite nationalism, which would mean that possibly a democratic China would be a more assertive China vis-a-vis its property rights, its the South China Sea issues, and so on. So
Now that's a real good question. The first thing to say about that is that the reason what's wrong with a democratic China is that any time in China or even polls now begin to show that Chinese people would like to have a say in their leaders, that they're not at all happy with having no political choice. So it's not for, you know, the good of someone else to have a democratic China. It's for the people of China. And if the people of China didn't want a democracy, it would be easy to have a vote in which they could vote not. Right? No one's asking them, you know, the Chinese Communist Party says the Chinese people want X and don't want Y. They seem to assume that they know, or that a poll would show, or a vote would show what the people want, but they avoid that kind of vote. On democratic peace theory, this is a point that comes up from time to time without getting into the debates on the theory itself. It is true that the Chinese people would be nationalistic, and the argument for a political opening in China is for its own stability. It's not based on the idea that it would be easier to deal with for other countries. It could well be. But I don't assume that if China were a democracy, it would therefore have no conflicts with other countries. I assume that China would still want Taiwan back, because, you know, you meet people all over China who say that, and it's just that isn't just an elite thing. I do think that the elites stoke nationalism from time to time. And so you can't believe it, but in the time that I was in China, the reform era, you didn't hear, literally, you could go months or a couple years without hearing phrases like China's century and a half of humiliation. You didn't hear that because the leadership didn't want to fuel that kind of sense. In fact, while I was in China, the Chinese leader for the Opium War against the British was a guy named Lin Zexu. And in Guangzhou, which was the heart of the fights over the Opium War in the 1800s, there was a big statue of Lin Zexu as the guy who resisted the British. And during my time there, that statue was taken from the center of town out to the outskirts. It's a little bit like, you know, in Eastern Europe when the statues of Stalin were taken out from the center of the city, because they really didn't want to. The climate at the time was to open to the outside world, and you can see China from time to time fuel the nationalism. You see this most acutely from time to time in dealing with Japan. The United States gets it from time to time, but if these sentiments were a constant, they wouldn't have to be either stoked or suppressed, depending on the moment.
Yes.
So in a recent interview, a former China ambassador to India, Zhuang Zhou, he said in reply to a question that why China is not supporting India in case of UNSCC. So he replied that India should apply on its own, rather than with its Asian partners like Korea and Japan. So do you think that if India applies alone, then China will support India?
No, I don't. I mean, in short, I think that China wants to be the only Asian vote in the Security Council. That is its bottom line policy. And whether India applies on its own or with others is irrelevant to China's position. And I realize, it complicates things that certainly Japan wants membership too. But one way or another, China's going to be opposed to any formulation where it doesn't have the only Asian seat.
So, what is your opinion about the future prospects of BRICS, with India and China have usually, you know, staying poles opposite of each other in regarding international issues? What do you think about that?
You know, BRICS was a good. You know, it was a good formulation. It started with a Goldman Sachs analyst and so on. 10 years ago, but I don't think it really has lasted. I don't think that the countries to have all that much in common with one another. Certainly, I have to say, China is just vastly ahead of the other countries, including India. And so it really stands, just analytically, I think it stands in a different category from the other RICS, I guess we would say. And so it doesn't surprise me that there are conflicts within. I mean, there are times and there are certain issues when countries like the some of the BRICS have common interests, particularly in dealing with the West or the United States. But you know, those will be, I think, ad hoc kind of issues rather than a real deep understanding. Is that what you mean, or yeah?
Like my friend Rivers said, for UNSSC, you said China wouldn't support India for a UNSSC. Do you think that US would support India for a UNSSC permanent seat? Or does US have the same vested interest like China? Like China wants to be a superpower in the eastern side of the earth. Don't you think that US still wants to be the hegemon power in the western side of the world?
Well, give me east and west. I'll give you the answer in it, but I'm not sure what you mean by east and west. The U.S. Wants to be the power, which
friends
is
friends and pals in the NATO, and the other side, the Western bloc from the Eastern bloc from the USSR regime. That's the Eastern bloc.
But then, why should it care to keep India out? First, in the formal. So let me just answer the question. In the formal sense. Of course, I mean, the United States, Obama went on record a couple years ago as supporting India's entry into the Security Council. That is the formal U.S. position, and formality counts for a lot. Now, you might ask, and it's a fair question informally, so how much is it doing? And, you know, the U.S. has tried in several ways to support UN reform, but is never quite really willing to deal with the underlying problems. So what are the underlying problems? In the East, China wants the only seat. We've talked about that. In Europe, the British and the French do not want for there to be what would make sense to everybody in this room, which would be there would be a single seat for the EU, right? But the British and French don't want that. And, you know, there's only so much the United States is willing to do to take on two countries that have been their most frequent partners around the world. So they say they do. I mean, don't get me wrong, the British and French get very upset every time the United States mentions Security Council reform. But that's the second political reality. And then you get into subsidiary questions. So should there be a single seat for Africa? If so, I mean, would Nigeria get it? Would it be South Africa? You know, there are countries up and down Latin America that would rather not have Brazil as the only seat in Latin America and so on. So that's the underlying politics. It's tough to change, and I'm afraid that the only way things are really going to change is with some unimaginable international upheaval. I mean, it took World War II to throw everything up in the air, such that the current system was formed, and it's 70 years old. It doesn't work. But that's the problem. Does that come? I mean, tell me. Come back to specifically to India if you want. And let me come back to American policy, because I'm sure we could all spend a couple of hours on this. But I will say personally, I'm surprised. Now you know you've heard me make jokes about there's the theorists, and then there's practicality, and that's true. In the sort of abstract foreign policy world, that I spend most of my days on in Washington, it said over and over and over again that the United States that has delinked India policy from Pakistan, that the U.S. no longer thinks of, you know, India, Pakistan, Pakistan, India, India, Pakistan, because India is something different and on a different order. Of course, when I get here and talk to people, you know, at the, you know, just ordinary people, it's not that simple, because I find that, you know, India obviously is still deeply concerned about Pakistan and tends to see the American policy as always as a plot to help Pakistan. To me, you know, in what I see, nothing could be further from the reality. I mean, Pakistan is at this point something necessary for the United States to have to deal with because of its nuclear program. But India is who it would much prefer to be dealing with. So there is a disjoint on American policy from, you know, the perspective on the ground here, where people still are devising conspiracies and plots beyond what really exists, I think, and sort of American policy. Now, and finally, I'll touch on the question that we could spend 3 years, you know, on debating. There is the underlying question of American policy, apart from India and Pakistan. And, you know, I will tell you that people here always tend to see a malign plot. The United States, generally speaking, and certainly with the Obama administration, tends to see its role in the world as essentially...
Guardians of their interests.
Well, I would say that under Obama, it would be like the doctor who has to examine parts of your body he doesn't want to. It's sort of someone has to do this. Someone has to...
I find it very hypocritical, because if you like have to scramble your F-22 rifles, it takes you 30 minutes to do it. And if you ask U.S., would you support India and UNSSC, it takes them 30 years to get an answer out of it.
Wait, what was the 30 minutes? I didn't hear the first part.
For F-22 Raptors, if you want to land your troops in Syria, it takes you 30 minutes. But if you have to support India and UNSSC, it takes you 30 years.
But in 2008, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, it came in a WikiLeaks report, that she said India is a self-declared front runner to the UN Security Council. She said India is a self-declared frontrunner for the UN Security Council.
WikiLeaks is something that they're very afraid of.
I'm not afraid of WikiLeaks at all. That's bull. Okay. I mean, I'm a okay. But I don't understand that India is a self-declared
frontrunner.
Yes. And what? So wait, let's get into English here. What's the problem with that? It is self-declared. It's also has the support of the United States by the formal. I mean, what's the matter with self-declared? Means to me, it believes it should be a member of the Security Council. It doesn't say the United States doesn't believe, and if it did, the United States has since changed its policy, right?
Yeah.
So last week I got a tweet from Diplomatic Courier by a former ambassador of US to India, Timothy Romart. He said this thing: the emergence of India in the global affairs is in the vital interest of the US. Why is it so? I mean, why does a foreign policy maker from US, why does he think that to emerge India in the global order, it has already emerged? Because in 2010, Obama, when he came here, he said India is not emerging, India is already emerged. In his speech in Bombay, he said that. And last week in the Diplomatic Courier, I got a tweet from them that Timothy Romart has written in some research journal or maybe in some newspaper, the emergence of India, that if India truly wants to emerge, it has to be in the vital interest of the US. That means he's saying that India has to support US. Why is it so, sir? Why does the US want to look at the emergence of the India from that aspect? We have good relations with Iran. US is apprehensive with that.
Well, so let's take the converse for a second. I mean, what is the matter with saying you're in favor of the emergence of India? What, suppose the United States said, we actually don't think India is an emerging power, and actually it doesn't count for much. Wouldn't you be equally angry? I mean, I you know, in order to be outraged by the statements you are outraged by, you have to be outraged beforehand, I think. Yeah.
What are the prospects of China as a soft power? Because if you see economically, China is a lot dependent on American economy too,
right,
because of the fact that they have a lot of government bonds in American economy. So in that sense, America has pretty much hold of Chinese economy, because any which way American economy gets down, China will also suffer. But in what prospects? Because Americanization of the entire society, America is a brand that sells because of its societal importance or culture. But do you think China can, what are the ways that China could perhaps become soft power?
Well, just, I mean, as a side on the bonds, of course, there are many people in the United States who believe that that it gives China power over the United States. In fact, the same Hillary Clinton, I think also in WikiLeaks, was found saying to the Australians, I think, how do you deal with the country that's your banker? So it's not clear with those bonds that it does give the U.S. power over China if it's just going to not pay the bonds. It also gives China power over the United States. But the question is about soft power. And China, and that's a terrific question, because China is trying to develop its own soft power in several ways. So they have now opened in the United States, and I don't know whether they have in India, Confucius Institutes as kind of an instrument of China's soft power. They are working with international media. If you call up the Washington Post's website most days of the week, you will find that the leading advertisement on there is from the China Daily. And that's a use of both attempt to develop soft power and also economic power, because then the advertising creates a kind of influence by itself. And the question is, so the problem, I think, so far is one of style. I think the Chinese, over a long period of time, may change. But there are things that China does not intend to be infuriating that are just part of China's style. So I'll give you an India example. You know, there's an article in the China Global Times, which is the nationalist paper, really, in China, a couple weeks ago, that said, you know, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is coming here. We think that the visit should be mostly about economic and commercial issues. Sort of, India should not raise the questions of the Brahmaputra River. And there's this kind of, there is an unintentional imperial tone and an effort to define issues as China wants them that gets in the way. I mean, imagine if India were to suddenly cut off, I mean, staple visas to China from a part of, from Chinese from a particular locality. So they have questions of style that get in the way of soft power, and they may adapt over the years.
Yeah. So, sir, there is, like, we have seen that there is a centralized inequality and administration on one hand, and a robust economy, you know, which is mostly liberal and opening up. And US is one of the major allies of China as far as business and trade are concerned. Sir, on the other hand, we have seen that US is always, you know, you still continue with the policy of, you know, making the world safer for democracy. Whether it was in the case of Vietnam, whether it's in the case of Iraq, whether it's in the case of Syria. So, but here, in as far as China is concerned, US doesn't want to, you know, ring the bells of democracy, you know, very often, because it is because of this, you know, communist centralized regime that they have a, you know, they have a, you know, organized economy and a robust, you know, so US doesn't want to disturb its own business.
I couldn't agree more strongly with the sentiments. I mean, most of my writing has been devoted to the question of why the United States does not press the issue of democracy with China. And the reason it doesn't changes from time to time. I mean, in the case of the Cold War was factor number one. All through the 70s and 80s, China was a partner in dealing with the Soviet Union, not an ally, but a partner. And then commercial things took over. And so you can't believe how strong the commercial interests were in the 1990s. I will say, you hear echoes of the same problem in India. So a joke I heard from an Indian military officer about China, you know the first two parts. So in 1962, before 1962, India's China policy was Hindi, Hindi, bye, bye, B-H-A-I. That after 62, it was B-Y-E, B-Y-E. And now, it's B-U-Y, B-U-Y. Maybe, yeah.
First of all, brother, I would like to say that Obama is a very sarcastic person. So when he says that India has emerged, it is actually not emerged. It is emerging. It's a people. Yeah. Secondly, I would like to ask you, it is something very unconventional or more of an opinion. I mean, I'm studying political science and have been studying it even before coming to college. I don't find a reason somebody should be supporting democratic elections. I mean, when you spend millions to reach people, to tell them that yes, we as politicians exist and vote us, it doesn't make sense to go in the election to set them and say, we did this and we are going to do this, and ask them for their vote. I mean, that doesn't make sense. That even makes the policies of a country, they start to make policies of a country based on their vote interest, rather than the interest of the nation. Like we see in India, we have something like the MGNREGA. Mahatma Gandhi National Rural Employment Guarantee Act. It is spending money on the policies to get people employed. Whereas China is developing its manufacturing sector and people are automatically getting employed. I don't find a reason somebody should be supporting free democratic elections.
Like
oligarchy or meritocracy makes more sense than democracy.
I think that's I'm not going to get into the debate on democracy itself because I think you guys are having. But
everybody sees China as a very negative nation which interferes too much into the personal lives of the people. It doesn't take their opinion. But why do we ignore their economic boom? Why do we ignore their employment? Why do we ignore the literacy rate? Why do we have to ignore all this?
It's a fair question why it's ignored. I mean, it's made tremendous and amazing progress on literacy and education.
That is something very realistic. That is something visible to us.
Yeah.
If you say, no, we don't want to see that, that still exists.
Happy to see it. On the emerging question, to me, it's kind of a theoretical thing. But there is a history with Obama and the Obama administration, which is that the Obama and the people really around him see themselves as a new generation. Whether they are or not is a real question. But they, as they came in, they're in opposition to the old fogies like Hillary Clinton and the people in her entourage. And in fact, they are much younger. Most of them were not involved in all the Cold War disputes. They weren't even involved in the 1990s, in all of the Bill Clinton administration debates. They really came of age after the Iraq War. And they tend to develop their own terminology. And so one of the people I was talking to went into a tear and said, why do they call China, India, emerging nations? As far as we're concerned, they've already emerged. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, when we went to the Copenhagen summit on climate change, who were we dealing with? I mean, who were the important actors? It was China, India, and so on. It wasn't the Dutch or the Germans. And so in that formulation, India, both of them are nations that have already emerged. And I think that's all he meant, but I have trouble seeing the practical implications of whether you call it emerging or emerged. I don't know whether I'm missing something there.
I guess we can take just one more question. Okay. Anybody who has not asked? Okay.
So China is going to full convert its currency, yuan. So it is going to extend its currency. So in, as you see in relation that if India is not going to convert, is not able to convert its full currency as the...
It's currency? Is that what you mean?
As this is the case of US dollar, pound and euro, they are fully convertible. So China is also going to make its currency full convertible. So if in future China is able to convert full convertibility is currency, then how it will affect India as both are emerging economies?
I honestly can't answer because I haven't thought how it would affect India. I mean, China, with great nervousness on its own, is slowly moving to convert its currency. And looking down the road, and I don't know if this, maybe this is realistic, you know, many years from now, is looking to become a reserve currency for other countries, so that comparable to the dollar.
Just two more, one over here and over.
Do you think U.S. has an option to support India when they have close ties with China, and China is fearful or not in very good terms with India in case of, because they would not want U.S. also to get close to India. So in case when they have to have a choice, and on the other hand, when U.S. is giving so much of financial aid to Pakistan too, so do you think it is any which way possible for U.S. to be in close ties with?
I left out of my my talk how U.S. policy has changed in the last 4 or 5 years. But really, when I said the U.S. policy has been to bring China into the international system, starting with the financial crisis of 2008, China did a reassessment, began to see the United States as in decline or in rapid decline, and came to start challenging the United States. And there were a series of episodes in 2009, one of them the Copenhagen summit. And then U.S. policy turned, and in my own view and impression, I mean, I'm just an outsider to the China hands in the United States, but they've completely changed. So I don't think the United States policy is not based on the assumption of a U.S. and China teaming up. I don't think people think that's possible at this point. And so the idea that the U.S. and China are close allies dealing with India doesn't match the reality that I see. And it was true in, you know, decades ago. Yeah.
Okay, just the final.
Yeah. All due respect to U.S. and the citizens of U.S., why is U.S. bothered so much about the country and the world not having democracy? How does it affect U.S.? Whereas U.S. remains silent when France banned wearing of burqa in French cities. It remained silent. So is U.S. hypocritical and delusional in its perspective?
Only if you assume that the United States... Only if you... Yeah, go ahead.
I support him. Everybody has a different perspective. Why does U.S. need to impose its perspective on other nations?
Yeah, McDonaldization of the world. Why does it need to do that?
UN.
Where is UN headquarters, please?
It's only when you assume that the United States is so active in pushing for democracy in China. The entire thrust of what I was saying in response to in this discussion was that it's not really, and that and China knows it. And so you do see the statements, the rhetorical support from time to time. But essentially, the United States has backed off continually from 40 years from pushing for democracy in China in concrete ways.
Somebody finds communism right for him. Like most of the China would say, we support communism. Mm-hmm. Most of the Arab world would say, we support Islamism. Somebody would support some democratic or some political system. I mean, like, but the U.S. that goes with are, they say, you are Islamist, you are terrorist. You are communist, you don't exist. We need democracy all over. We need our perspective to reinforce that exist.
If China were to have a vote of even part of 1.2 or 4 billion people, and they voted that we wanted a communist system, I don't see the problem with that. But that's not what's going on.
Like you said that
US
140, last thing, like US has stopped interfering in world politics, imposing democracy. But Obama took a very strong stand when Iraq developed nuclear technology. You took a very strong stand. So again, you're contradicting your own statement. Iran.
Just on U.S. support for democracy, what happened when the Green Movement was in the streets in 2009? How much did the Obama administration push for democracy? I mean, some of us would say not enough, but I think everybody would say not very much, right?
Sorry to interrupt. I could have continued this one. I think it's very fascinating. Yeah. But I think Professor James Mann has a very tight schedule and he has to leave immediately after this. So thank you so much for your time.
I wanted to, sir.
Thank you so much.
For the library here.
This is for the departmental library.
Okay.
Everybody can have it. Everybody can have it. So if you have interest, you can contribute maybe some more books. So please visit us again, and
okay, thanks.
So that we can have a nice, vigorous speaker. Thank you so much.